evidence for Christ's resurrection, the first thing we had to establish was that miracles are possible so long as a personal God exists. And there's good evidence that a personal God exists. Therefore, miracles are possible. Doesn't mean they're actual, doesn't mean they actually occurred, but it means that we have to examine each miracle claim and investigate each miracle claim, not rule it out beforehand due to any philosophical assumptions that we may have. The next point we need to make is that Christ's resurrection was bodily. You know, the Jehovah's Witnesses, even some evangelical scholars, try to argue that Jesus rose spiritually from the dead and not bodily from the dead. But, you know, Matthew 28:6, the angel tells the ladies visiting the tomb that he is not here, he is risen. So the body was gone. So, you know, Jehovah's Witnesses would turn around and say, well, then that's due to the fact that his body somehow disintegrated into gases. And I don't know what that means, but when you look at John chapter 2, verses 19 through 21, you know, Jesus had just cleansed the temple. The Jewish religious leader said, well, give us a sign to show that you have the authority to cleanse the temple. And he said, okay, destroy this temple and I'll raise it up in 3 days. Now, John said he was talking about the temple of his body. So Jesus was saying, destroy my body, I'll raise it up in 3 days. So Jehovah's Witnesses may not like it, but Jesus taught that he would bodily rise from the dead. John 20, 26 and 27, he tells Thomas to touch the wounds in his hands and his feet. You know, the Jehovah's Witnesses, are they to have us believe that Jesus had a pseudo body, a phony body, you know, a fake body that would appear and look like a real body, and then God's going to go to the point of putting fake wounds that mimic the real wounds that he had on the cross? You know, I don't think so. And Luke 24, verses 36 to 43, the apostles, you know, Jesus appeared to them, and the doors were locked, so the apostles thought, okay, you know, he's got to be a spirit. So, you know, they were ready to become the first Jehovah's Witnesses. But Jesus said, look, I am not a spirit. I have a body of flesh and bones. He told him to touch his wounds, and then he said, here, give me a piece of fish, and he ate fish in their midst. He went way out of his way to prove that he was there bodily. In 1 Corinthians 15, when Paul talks about the spiritual body versus the natural body, and let me say this, the spiritual body and the natural body, it's... The word natural comes from psuche, the Greek word for soul. And spiritual body, the word spiritual comes from the word pneuma, for spirit. So to be consistent, they should translate it either, and no modern translation do this, but to be consistent, they should either translate it as soulish body. You know, the bodies we have right now are soulish bodies, but, you know, we'll be buried in a soulish body, but it will be raised a spiritual body. Or, if they want to call the soulish body the natural body, that's fine, but then call the spiritual body the supernatural body. Okay, in other words, they should at least be consistent there. But the fact that a spiritual body... The word there, the Greek word for body there is soma. It's spiritual in some way, but it's still a physical body. It's still a soma, okay? A spiritual body is no more non-physical than a soulish body is. Okay? I mean, if you say, well, it's a spiritual body, it's got to be spiritual, it can't be physical. And we say, well, then a soulish body isn't really physical because it's soulish. But the soulish body is the body we have right now that we're talking about. Well, whatever the case, when you look at 1 Corinthians 15 and verses 42 to 44, Even New Testament scholars there try to claim that Paul had a different type of appearance of Jesus, received a different type of appearance of Jesus, because he defines it, he says it's a spiritual body. When talking about Christ's resurrection body and the resurrection body will receive, when in actuality, you know, these guys are doing damage to the text by claiming that a spiritual body is somehow less than physical. That's the, you know, if you study the passage, that is not the case. So you look at verses 42 to 44 of 1 Corinthians 15, and Paul says this, "So also is the resurrection of the dead. The body is sown, the body is buried in corruption, it is raised in incorruption." What is the pronoun it? I mean, it's talking about the same body, okay? It is sown in dishonor, what? The bodies, our natural bodies, the bodies we have now. It is raised in glory. That makes no sense if those two pronouns, it, refer to something different. So it's saying the same body that is going to be buried in dishonor and shame and corruption is going to be raised incorruptible in a glory and in power. Verse 44, it is sown a natural body, a soulish body. It is raised a spiritual body. There is a natural body and there is a spiritual body. So he's talking about the same body, but it will be changed. And the way I understand it, when we look at Jesus's supernatural body or spiritual body, is the only thing we're going to lose, I believe, is basically the presence of sin and all the weaknesses of human flesh, whereas what we're going to put on, in other words, it's not going to be less than our bodies now, but it's going to be more than our bodies now. So we're going to have additional powers, and I do believe that it's going to be a body, the same spiritual body, the same body, but in a glorified and empowered state, so that no longer will the world of the senses pose the same limitations upon us that they have in the past. And I think when we think, well, you know, preachers all over this country saying that Jesus, when we receive, when we see him, we'll be like him. We'll receive a resurrection body like his resurrection body, so we'll have a body that will be able to go through walls. That is so much of an underestimation of Jesus' resurrection body. I mean, if you make that assumption, then what you're saying is if somebody was walking by the upper room in Jerusalem at that point, they would have seen Jesus from the outside seeping into the wall? I don't think so. I mean, what do you got to do with Jesus for 40 days? I guess his resurrection body I guess he had to hide probably, you know, 95% of the time during the 40 days of appearances, hide somewhere so no one would see him, so he could just appear once a week. You know, it doesn't make sense. His ascension into heaven, if we assume he's got to go through the whole universe, if he's going to just travel bodily to heaven, you know, then this guy's got to get cooking. I mean, he's got to get way faster than the speed of light, otherwise he's still traveling now and he hasn't reached heaven. So, to me, I think we water down the resurrection body by talking about Jesus going through walls. I don't think that was the factor. I think it's basically the limitations of space, of matter, are not the, it's a body that has material aspects to it, but the supernatural realm, the spiritual realm, can override those limitations anytime the person feels like it. So basically, I see it more as Jesus traveling at the speed of thought than anything else. So he could have been at the Father's right hand and then thought, okay, I want to be in the upper room. Boom, he's in the upper room. I mean, a slow motion version of this would be the old Star Trek shows where they dematerialized and rematerialized. Even that's too slow for what we're talking about here. And I mean, he's just there. He just appears. You know, I mean, if he's going through the wall, somebody could have glanced over and might have seen, you know, a finger coming through, a hand coming through. I don't think that's what's going on there. So keep in mind that it is the body in which Jesus was crucified. That body was raised, but it was transformed, it was glorified, it was given powers that it did not have before, and yet it's the same body, but it's in glorified state.
He's going to keep the wounds for eternity?
Yeah, he'll keep the wounds for eternity. What he did not keep was that battered visage. A close reading of Isaiah, which is very consistent to the New Testament description, the Gospels descriptions of the beatings that Christ received, and the crown of thorns, and then the scourging, and then the crucifixion. He was battered beyond recognition. I mean, Isaiah 53 implies that people couldn't even look at him. I mean, it's, you know, it's almost like looking at a guy so battered and torn apart that it takes a while to figure out, oh, wait a minute, that's a human being. And then you're repulsed by it, and you turn your head, and you almost say, oh my God, what is it? You know, it's a horrifying thing. Well, Jesus isn't going to be sitting on the throne with thick blood dripping from his nose and a face so battered that even his own mother wouldn't be able to recognize him. And you'd be able to see all his bones. No, it's going to be his body, to some extent, in perfect condition, with just the five wounds, the wounds in the hands, the pierced hands, the pierced feet, and the pierced side. And as a reminder to us, so that I believe that we'll be taking people on tours to Jerusalem, into the temple, into the Holy of Holies, where Jesus is sitting enthroned, and point to Jesus and explain where those wounds came from. To try to lead people growing up in the millennial kingdom to Christ. And sad thing is that most people on earth are going to back Satan when he's released from the abyss at the end of the millennial kingdom. But whatever the case, Christ's resurrection was bodily. By the way, a further argument here. The entire ancient Jewish concept of resurrection demands a bodily resurrection. It is totally meaningless once you remove. I mean, it was inconceivable to ancient Jewish rabbis that you could talk about a resurrection in which the corpse was still rotting in the tomb. So, I mean, we can pervert and corrupt the Jewish doctrine, ancient Jewish doctrine of resurrection, and turn it into a purely spiritual resurrection. But the fact of the matter is, that's a 20th century perversion of the ancient Jewish doctrine of resurrection. Figurative language in the Old Testament for dying is people falling asleep, so too the resurrection is the sleeping people becoming awake.
Well, and see the big parallelism to Jesus saying she's not dead, but
yeah,
asleep.
Yeah. So it's just, you know, it we have to torture the text to escape the obvious. Oh, by the way, just as a side note, we were talking about New Testament reliability for the last few weeks, and all. I found out that Charlesworth, he is not an evangelical. I think there's only about 30 to 50 facts that he believes that the Gospels, even if we go into it with a critical approach, there's like 30 to 50 facts that we have to acknowledge. When you look at those facts, it's real easy to make a case for Christ's resurrection and miraculous life. But Charlesworth at a Princeton Theological Seminary, apparently Carsten P. Thede reported that at a conference at Notre Dame, Charlesworth is arguing for an early date of the Gospel of John, a pre-70 AD date, which agrees with John A.T. Robinson, the late John A.T. Robinson, who was a neo-Orthodox theologian or New Testament critic that eventually converted to Christ. But Charles Worth is arguing that it could be as early as the 50s A.D. So I don't know what he's on to, but it would be amazing if the New Testament Christology was that well developed that quickly. At such an early date. But whatever the case, the next point we need to acknowledge is the importance of the resurrection. 1 Corinthians 15, verse 14, Paul says this, "And if Christ is not risen, then our preaching is vain, and your faith is also vain." What Paul's saying there is if Bishop Spong, former Archbishop of the Episcopal Church in Newark, now he's a lecturer at Harvard, if he doesn't believe in the resurrection, if he denies the resurrection, his preaching isn't worth 2 cents, let alone the six-digit salary he's probably getting. Verse 17, "And if Christ is not risen, your faith is futile, you are still in your sins." You could have the Islamic faith doesn't change one bit with Muhammad's body rotting in the tomb. The Buddhist faith isn't heard at all with Buddha's body rotting in the tomb. Confucius's death and rotting corpse doesn't hurt his philosophical system. You know, the list goes on and on. But the fact of the matter is, you take the resurrection out of Christianity, there is no Christianity left whatsoever. I mean, it was so vital that early in church history, in Romans 10:9, it became an ancient baptismal rite where, you know, if you confess with your mouth Jesus is Lord and believe that God raised him from the dead, you will be saved. But people had to publicly announce this just to be water baptized. I mean, it was considered part of the gospel message. Look at 1 Corinthians 15. Paul says, starting in verse 1, "Moreover, brethren, I declare to you the gospel, the good news which I preached to you, which also you received and in which you stand, by which also you are saved." And he goes on to verse 3, he says, "For I delivered to you as of first importance all that which I also received, that Christ died for our sins according to the Scriptures, that he was buried, and that he rose again the third day according to the Scriptures." You see, Paul is saying, I am going to declare to you the gospel. And then he talks about Christ's death, burial, and resurrection. Paul could not envision good news without the resurrection. Now, today, when we witness, very rarely do we even mention the resurrection. And very rarely do we even mention the deity of Christ. Yet Jesus basically said, unless you believe I'm Yahweh, you're going to die in your sins. So we get people who ask Jesus into their hearts. And I knew a lady that was leading kind of a girls' youth group and would lead them in praise and worship songs. And I kind of asked her, you know, when did you come to Christ and blah, blah, blah. And she said, well, I was really hurting about 10 years ago and I asked Jesus into my heart. And I started talking with her. She didn't know anything about why Jesus died. She didn't even know really much. She knew that, you know, that Jesus rose, but she didn't really know what that meant, whether it was a bodily resurrection. So we literally have millions of people who profess to be born again Christians that don't even understand the death and resurrection of Jesus of Nazareth, and they don't even know that he's God. You know, that's why Barna's research shows that I think one of every three evangelical Christians who professes to be born again and trust in Jesus alone for salvation, or professes to be born again, calls himself an evangelical, regularly attends evangelical churches, one of every three still think that it is possible to save yourself by your works. You know, what's wrong with this picture here? So But the resurrection is essential to true Christianity. It is an essential aspect of the good news. Take away the resurrection and there is no hope, there is no salvation through Christ. Now, having said that miracles are possible, Christ's resurrection was bodily, the resurrection is essential to Christianity, we now move on to our defense of the Christian doctrine of the resurrection. The two foremost experts, the two foremost conservative evangelical experts on the historicity of Christ's resurrection are my old professor at Liberty University, Gary Habermas. Dr. Michael Martin, in his case, The Case Against Christianity, acknowledges Habermas as the best. Okay, and John Ankerberg would confer with this, by the way. I think it's pretty much without a doubt where these guys stand. And the other one is William Lane Craig. Both of them are friends of mine, great guys, love the Lord. But let me just show you from some of their research. Yeah. Well, Habermas is not known as well as like Craig, mainly because Habermas, and I don't mean it's derogatory to Craig, but Habermas teaches for a living. So basically, you know, this is like with me teaching at King's West, the full teaching load, and then trying to pastor a church, you know, I'll take 20 talks a year, tops, but that's about it. And I don't even look for debates anymore. I only take them if I get them. Habermas has that full teaching mode, and and you know, he'll teach some undergraduate courses, but for the most part, his key students are going to be on the master's level, and it's not uncommon to have like 12, 15 students in this class and 20 in another. I'm actually teaching apologetics right now to way more people than Habermas is. For two reasons. Number one, because I'm teaching on the high school level, so you have bigger classes. He's teaching on the master's level. Liberty on the undergraduate level sometimes pack in 60 in a class, which is really, it's messed up. It's way too many. But rarely do they have a class of under 25 or 30. You know, I'm teaching classes of 20 to 25, but on the master's level, you're talking, you know, 10 to 15 tops. And, but, you know, but these are going to be great apologists. You know, these are people, you know, but basically what I'm doing with you guys, he's doing with a group about five times his size. But, you know, I have several classes that I'll teach each day, so he might have 50, 60, 70 students that he teaches a year, really gets into the nitty-gritty with them. You know, I get 150 a year. But, of course, mine are just high school kids. Most of the stuff's going to be out of their minds, you know, a few years from now, which is really unfortunate. So you'll have these scholars. So the guys he reaches in the books that he sells, but I think he had the first book on the Shroud that he wrote that sold about 250,000 books. But beyond that, his books usually don't sell more than a few thousand copies. The Historical Jesus, one of the most scholarly works on the subject, published by College Press, they only put it out, first printing 2,000 copies. It's the same amount of books we put out with The God Who Sits Enthroned. So, I mean, you know, now William Lane Craig, who doesn't have the full-time teaching load, he'll speak, you know, 150 times a year on college campuses throughout the country. You know, but and by the way, Craig's books probably sell even worse than Habermas's. So, you know, that's pretty sad. But what establishes them is their expertise is the guys that they debate. I mean, here Craig is debating a leading German scholar, New Testament scholar. But I have a book where he debates, I don't know which of the Jesus, Peter Crossan. John Dominic, wasn't Peter Crossan. John Dominic Crossan of the Jesus Seminar. He debates him, and that's another book that I have. Habermas twice has debated Anthony Flew of Great Britain, the world's leading agnostic philosopher alive, and Flew never even came close to showing up to either debate. Flew's problem is he's too honest to, you know, he doesn't bluff in the debate, so if he doesn't have anything to offer, if you refuted his argument, he doesn't bring it up again. So about halfway through the debates, he just becomes a listener, he becomes part of the audience, and Habermas gets the whole podium because the debate's over. And but yeah, whatever the case, they're not... Now, on the John Ankerberg show, they get a lot of airtime. And Ankerberg, is Ankerberg one of the best apologists in America? No. But he's smart enough, he's done enough homework to know who the best apologists in America, in fact, in the world are. And those are the guys he has on his show. So he's putting out some dynamite stuff. And through the Institute, we have some great stuff on Habermas and one of his debates with Flew. We have about six episodes of Habermas just speaking about evidence for the Jesus of history. And we've got one, I think one of Craig's debates. So we have a lot of their stuff that is out there. But yeah, they don't... it's weird. If popularity made... and media exposure made scholarship, determined scholarship, and the Jesus Seminar would be the most scholarly guys on the planet. But it doesn't, and unfortunately, if your message is not popular, yeah, there's a good chance that you could be very scholarly and not be heard. However, William Lane Craig did make it to Crossfire to debate. I don't know which member of the spokesperson for the Jesus Seminar, and that's when their book Jesus Under Fire came out, which Moreland and J.P. Moreland, another friend of mine, and Wilkins co-edited it, and but Craig contributed to it as well as Habermas and some of the leading scholars. And then it's what, you know, everybody talks about Lee Strobel's work, you know, The Case for Christ. There's a chapter in there by Craig and a chapter by Habermas, both dealing with the resurrection. So, you know, Strobel knows the right guys to go to, too. And whatever the case, Habermas, he calls these historical facts in his work, The Resurrection of Jesus, unfortunately published by, this was put back in print, published by University Press of America. What that means is, nobody wanted to put it back in print, so these guys will put in print your scholarly work, but they'll do like as low as like only 100 copies or so just to fill the libraries throughout the country and things of that sort. They were interested in publishing my dissertation, but it would have been like 100 copies and $20 a copy. And I just thought, you know, we could do better than that. Basically, he says this. This data reveals at least 10 facts which are accepted as historical by virtually all scholars who study this subject, in spite of the various differences in other areas of their thought. So what, you know, the Jesus Seminar is just... they are scholars and non-scholars who have decided to just ignore modern scholarship, current scholarship. What Habermas is saying is when you examine, this is Craig and Habermas both in the defense of the, both of them defending Christ's resurrection, wrote 600 to 700 page dissertations at leading universities. And so they've examined all this stuff, and Habermas says these are pretty much undisputed facts, considered undisputed facts, and he lists 10 of them. Jesus, number one, Jesus died because of crucifixion. Number two, he was buried. Number three, the disciples became very discouraged, having lost hope because of his death. Number four, Jesus' tomb was found empty soon after his burial. This is almost universally accepted now. Number five, a few days after Jesus' death, the disciples had experiences which they believed were literal appearances of the risen Jesus. Number six, because of these experiences, the disciples' lives were completely transformed to the point of being willing to die for their belief. Number seven, the disciples' public testimony concerning the resurrection took place in Jerusalem, where Jesus was crucified and buried shortly before. Number eight, the Christian church had its beginning at this time. Number nine, Sunday became the primary day of worship. And number ten, a few years later, Paul became a believer because of an experience which he also believed to be an appearance of the risen Jesus. So he said, basically, you just take those 10 historical facts and all the alternative theories of Christ's resurrection, the naturalistic alternatives, just do not deal with all these factors. Yet, he says, Habermas says, well, I'll tell you what, though, I'll go even further. And he says this, a third extremely strong evidential point in favor of the historicity of Jesus' resurrection concerns a further usage of the 10 accepted historical facts surrounding this event, which were given at the beginning of this chapter. It is the author's belief that even if we were to use only 4 of these facts, we would still have a sufficient case by which we could demonstrate that this event is probable. By the way, that's all you could do with historical events to show that it had occurred with a high degree of probability. The 4 facts we will utilize here are Jesus' death by crucifixion, the disciples' experiences which they believed to be appearances of the risen Jesus, the subsequent transformation of these men, and the conversion of Saul of Tarsus because of an experience which he also believed was an appearance of the risen Jesus. These 4 core historical facts are unanimously accepted as historical by virtually all scholars who study this subject, in spite of their differences in other areas of their thought. So he just takes 4 facts, Christ's death by crucifixion, the disciples' experiences, which they believed were post-resurrection appearances of Christ, the transformation of their lives, and the conversion of the soul of Tarsus. He argues just from those 4 historical factors alone, even without the empty tomb, there's no other plausible explanation other than Jesus did in fact rise from the dead. William Lane Craig, in his work, The Sun Rises, states this, according to Jacob Kremer, a German scholar who has specialized in the study of the resurrection, and then he quotes from Kremer, by far most exegetes hold firmly to the Craig later on says that he should have used the word in a journal article. He says that what Kremer calls them exegetes, they're more commonly known as New Testament critics. By far most exegetes hold firmly to the reliability of the biblical statements over the empty tomb, and he lists 28 prominent scholars in support. So then, after listing these 28, Craig says, I can think of at least 16 more names that he neglected to mention. Okay? So, 16 plus 28 is 44 of the world's most prominent New Testament critics acknowledge the empty tomb. Okay? Then Craig says this, the prominent German New Testament commentator, Rudolf Schnackenberg, agrees that most exegetes accept the historicity of the empty tomb, so that this question is not the decisive point in the discussion about the resurrection. In other words, the resurrection is still being debated, because not all New Testament critics believe. The resurrection is still being debated, but was not being debated among the world's cutting-edge scholars, is the empty tomb.
But they don't believe in Craig. Sure, the tomb's empty, but he didn't really rise. He could have been stolen, or he just swooned on the cross, and he stabbed the wrong guy.
Actually, you're not going to find that much of that in scholarship.
Really?
Right now, the present case, because in the 20th century,
I don't think the church would have been as big.
What? Oh, yeah, and that's...
Because you just think about it. If you were against Jesus, and of course, you found his body, I would not only would parade it around the streets,
mm-hmm.
but I would also destroy it
yeah.
in front of all those people.
Well, yeah, but the thing is, though, is if you talk about New Testament scholars, though, cutting edge New Testament critics, you will find they almost unanimously acknowledge the empty tomb, and they consider that a mute point now. That to disregard it would be foolishness. But you aren't going to hear them saying anymore that he swooned on the cross. You'll hear non-scholars saying that, but basically they refuted their own views in the 20th century. Actually, it was the late 19th century and early 20th century. So that basically... the alternative naturalistic theories have all but crumbled. So normally, what you will hear is an acknowledgement of like the 10 historical facts that Habermas talks about, or even his 4 core historical facts, which don't include the empty tomb, plus the acknowledgement of the empty tomb. So now we can call it 5 core historical facts. You'll hear the acknowledgement of that, and then no alternative hypothesis proposed. They just leave it there and suspend judgment. But if they are forced into a corner, like during a debate, which most of them won't take debates because they don't want to be forced into a corner, they don't want to have to make a decision on it, they want to remain skeptic and suspend judgment. But if in a debate forced into a corner, then they will do the Anthony Flew thing, and that's try to revive in a veiled manner, sometimes even after acknowledging that I don't espouse the hallucination theory, but you will hear some type of new the same old hallucination theory with a new twist. And if you watched Habermas debate Flew, their second debate on the resurrection on the John Ankerberg show, Habermas showed how easily that any version of the hallucination theory is to refute. So when we're talking about the New Testament critics, the reason why these guys, the world's leading New Testament scholars, the reason why this is so important is because these guys study the text and they go into the New Testament text with a bias that they don't have for any other book, against any other book, and they say guilty till proven innocent, but the research has forced them to acknowledge so much of the New Testament as being historically reliable, that they give the evangelical all the premises and the evangelical argument for Christ's resurrection. They just don't draw they choose not to draw the conclusion. And then you say, well, what other conclusion are you going to draw? Well, any conclusion they try to draw doesn't do justice to some, if not all, of those historical facts that they've acknowledged. And so it's more of a hands-off. I think the safest thing for non-believing scholars to do is, if you want to reject Christ, throw your scholarship out the window and join the Jesus Seminar. And is John Dominic Crossan a scholar? Is Marcus Borg a scholar? Is Funk a scholar? Oh yeah, they're tremendous. They've proven their scholarship, but in recent times, they've also proven that they're also willing to use their scholarship to promote unscholarly conclusions and to ignore tons of evidence. Yeah, they're using the weight of their scholarship to argue for unscholarly positions. And holds that Jesus was just thrown into a grave of common thieves. I mean, come on now. I mean, William Lane Craig argues that
at times you can hear, and even in Klassen's voice, because I heard him actually speak, and it does seem like he's forcing himself to say that.
Yeah,
doesn't seem
the most powerful thing of his argument when you hear him talk is tone is part of nonverbal communication. It's not the words, but the way you say something is, and it's the most powerful thing in his argument aspect of his argumentation is how he talks down. It's like, well, of course, you know, we've got to get with it. This is the 20th century. And what is proven scientifically from the 20th century and the 21st century, we know that dead bodies stay dead. So that's not an option for a modern scientific man. You know, and then he just goes on and proposes his, you know. But William Lane Craig argues you've got to go a long way to find New Testament scholars who deny the biblical account of Jesus' burial in Joseph of Arimathea's tomb. I mean, I forget if they call it enemy attestation, but it's just basically, you don't, if you have opponents that are trying to knock your movement out of existence, and they have access to your teachings and your writings, you don't make up, you don't say, well, one of our leading one of their leading men, our opponents, on the Sanhedrin, the Jewish ruling council, one of their members, a wealthy and powerful man, was a secret believer in Jesus and actually had Jesus buried in his tomb, and then went through this type of burial, which we now know is consistent with first century Jewish burial customs, although a rushed burial at that. Because all your opponents have to do is say, well, Joseph Arimathea, there is no such a guy. There's no such guy at all. Here's the records to prove it. Joseph Arimathea exists, but he didn't give his tomb, and we're going to bring him out here to make a statement. You know, I mean, so you just don't do that. And if they did make it up, that in itself, even without the producing the rotting corpse of Christ, as if it existed, even without that, that would crush Christianity just on a bogus claim like that. So now it's almost universally accepted that yes, Joseph of Arimathea was a member of the Sanhedrin, and did give his tomb and provide for the burial and ask Pilate for permission to bury Christ. And what New Testament critics see as consistent with that is the fact that you never hear of him again in ancient church history. When you think that if you're going to make up that story, you can milk this for a lot of mileage, but the fact of the matter is, this was a guy who threw away his political and theological career, you know, and it was like, okay, well, you know, and I'm sure that he was a real nice elder in some small local church in the Jerusalem area, but the fact of the matter is, it was like, hey, I'm going to let these young guys who are trained directly by Jesus run the show, and I'm going to stay in the background. I don't have their youth, their vitality, and I've just got to spend the rest of my time rethinking what I've learned sitting under their teeth. But, you know, he didn't rise to, you know, Nicodemus.
Okay.
You know,
there's another strong point, too, though, that goes along with what Carlito was saying, the advocate. They're trying to rob the body. Now, is there a lot of historical evidence, anyway, for the Roman guard that was standing outside the tomb? Because that should be stressed.
It's one of the points that is it is gaining more and more support from New Testament critics today. My guess is that the vast majority of New Testament, leading New Testament critics acknowledge the Roman guard at the tomb of Jesus. And the ones that don't, most of them would hold to the temple guard there, because Pilate said, you have a guard. And so some would say, okay, well then that would entail a temple guard. But it seems with the ceiling of the tomb, that's Roman guard is what it appears to be. But whatever the case, again, that's a story that you don't fabricate a story like that when it's so easy to refute.
Right, and
you know,
and that watchman or whatever. And a lot of things people forget is that the Jesus seminar especially, think of people 2,000 years ago as being stupid because they're falling for for the virgin birth and things like that. But but more than that, I mean, they're not going to allow these Christian men to steal the body, so of course they're going to set up a guard.
And the thing is, too, is what we need to understand about the Jesus seminar, in a day and age where modernism is dead and it's being replaced by postmodernism, okay? So the modernism, scientism, the belief that through science we're going to find all truth and solve every problem, that science has disproved miracles, okay? Whereas postmodernism, now you're getting all these unsolved mysteries and miracle shows and the cult and New Age type things. In a day and age where modernism is dead, Jesus Seminar is a throwback to outdated scholarship, and they still have the modernistic premise that miracles are impossible, they could never happen, modern science has disproven all this stuff, the ancient Christians were a bunch of ignorant Neanderthals.